Part 1. A Ground Level Perspective. Introduction to the expanded and annotated 28 articles. The chapter that follows began as a response to the frustration of frontline soldiers, junior officers, and non-commissioned officers with the wars they were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, along with my own frustration at our need to clearly explain what we wanted our civilian and military teams to do in a complex environment on the ground. The chapter is best understood in the context of the period when it was written in early 2006, a time of rapid change within the U.S. military, the Foreign Service, the intelligence community, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other departments, like the Departments of Homeland Security, Justice, and Agriculture, which were struggling to adapt to the new conditions. The New Counterinsurgency Manual. The most important initiative of this period was the writing of the new Army and Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual, Counterinsurgency, FM-324, which was put together by a writing team led by West Point History Professor Conrad Crane, under the direction of Army General David Petraeus and Marine Corps General James Mattis. As an Army and Marine Corps collaborative effort, this manual's writing process was unprecedented at that time. Rigorous review involving practitioners, academics, diplomats, aid officials, intelligence officers, human rights experts, lawyers, and journalists was inflicted on the manual. Its scope, philosophy, politics, strategy, history, minor tactics, administration, was panoramic. Some sections read more like a meditation on counterinsurgency than a how-to handbook. This was the first U.S. military manual with an annotated bibliography. It was downloaded more than 600,000 times within 24 hours of appearing on the Internet. I was in Baghdad when I finished reading the first draft of the manual. It was February 2006, the week after the Samarra mosque bombing transformed the war. For many coalition civilians in Baghdad, the fighting seemed distant then, somehow offstage. Lots of people were getting killed, but you rarely experienced an incident firsthand, and apart from the occasional mortar attack, if you tried very, very hard, you could pretend things were almost normal. Oily black car bomb smoke drifted over Baghdad, and we moved between the capital and other towns by Black Hawk. Scarcely a police or army checkpoint was visible as the flat-roofed villages scrolled beneath our boots out the wide-open helicopter doors, each roof with its satellite dish tuned to Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya. The clock was ticking then, in the last hours before the storm of sectarian violence that tore the country apart through the rest of 2006 and into 2007. In late March, back in my cluttered second-floor room in the counterterrorism office at the State Department, I was approached by Marine Corps Captain Scott Cuomo on behalf of a small group of Marine Corps and Army officers who were engaged in writing the Small Unit Operations Guide, a companion piece to the new field manual, designed to give junior commanders a set of tactics, techniques, and procedures for counterinsurgency. Scott, who was an instructor at the basic school at the enormous Marine Corps base at Quantico, Virginia, was a talented and experienced officer who graduated from the Naval Academy in 2001, and, like his whole generation of the Army and Marine Corps, was thrown straight into the war, commanding an infantry platoon in Iraq from the end of 2002 until 2005. At the time of writing, he is commanding Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marines in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. On this day, he had struggled through 90 minutes of rainy rush-hour traffic to Foggy Bottom to get to my office to express the general frustration shared by a lot of his peers. The field manual tells us what to achieve, but not what to do. It lays out the theory, but we need practical advice at company level. Can you help us think it through? Bottom-up tactical innovation. It is important to remember that by this time, more than 4 years into the war in Afghanistan and 3 years into Iraq, tactical commanders like Scott were already much more experienced in the realities of counterinsurgency warfare than most senior officers or academic counterinsurgency experts. The junior commanders had fought through that first chaotic period in Iraq and Afghanistan, living through the difficult time in 2003 to 2004 when field operators realized clearly that they were in a counterinsurgency fight, but for political reasons, a desire not to legitimize the enemy, and through institutional inertia, the Defense Department refused to recognize this. Senior commanders would not even use the words insurgency or counterinsurgency. Many junior officers realized early that the way they had been trained to fight was not going to work in this environment, and that their institutions and the older generation of leaders did not have the answers they needed. So they had begun, on their own initiative, looking to past doctrine and experience of counterinsurgency to fill the gap. But to these field operators, many of the prescriptions laid out in classical counterinsurgency literature or in interim doctrinal publications such as the October 2004 Interim Field Manual, Counterinsurgency Operations, seemed unrealistic, outdated, or hard to apply in places like Fallujah, Ramadi, or the Bermel Valley. Senior officers, everybody from the rank of major upward at this time, had grown up on a diet of Cold War exercises with a focus on conventional, that is, state-on-state, force-on-force warfare against the Soviets, leavened by the extremely brief and successful 100-hour ground campaign during the first Gulf War of 1990 to 1991. Some had gained extremely valuable experience in peace operations in Somalia, the Balkans, East Timor, Liberia, and Sierra Leone during the 1990s. As Dr. Janine Davidson shows in her definitive study of military organizational learning in the 1990s, Lifting the Fog of Peace, How Americans Learned to Fight Modern War, commanders applied this knowledge to their new environment in Iraq and Afghanistan with excellent effect in some cases. But as she convincingly demonstrates, these were ad hoc adaptations, unsupported, indeed sometimes actively undermined, by existing institutions and senior officials, and applied in a patchy, inconsistent manner that was largely determined by the outlook and experience of individual commanders and units. But the military as an institution had also learned how to learn, and this turned out to be critically important. The Army had established training facilities like the National Training Center and the Joint Readiness Training Centers, where units were tested in dynamic, unforgiving, two-sided exercises, and had created processes like the Lessons Learned System and the After-Action Review, which encouraged radically honest criticism and self-criticism. As the Fog of Peace shows, even before the outbreak of war in Afghanistan and Iraq, this had done a huge amount to give soldiers and Marines the tools to learn from their experiences and adapt quickly when the time came. Doctrine, the body of institutional knowledge captured in military field manuals, was and is a critical part of this toolkit. To the casual observer, field manuals can seem like straightforward descriptions of what happens in battle, along with authoritative guidance on how military forces operate. But their primary organizational function is actually as adaptation and acculturation tools. Doctrine is not only an idealized description of how things are done, but also an attempt to inculcate habits of mind and action that change organizational culture and behavior. It is an institutional rudder that helps turn the enormous bureaucracies it informs. As such, and this gives field manuals their fascination for literary, cultural, and political analysts, field manuals say less about how a given military force actually behaves than about how it wants to behave and the direction in which its leaders, or a faction within its officer corps, are pushing it. This matters because, as discussed already, in counterinsurgency, success depends on adaptability in the face of a rapidly evolving insurgent threat and a changing environment. Armies that successfully read this environment and adapt using tools like field manuals are more apt to succeed. Of course, this is not unique to counterinsurgency. The Dynamics of Doctrine, Timothy Lupfer's study of German tactical adaptation on the Western Front, written in the early 1980s, emphasizes the role of manuals and training notes in helping armies adapt under the intense pressure of combat. And it is intense. During a tour in command of training efforts in Iraq in 2004, General Petraeus likened building the Iraqi army to constructing an aircraft in flight while being shot at. The counterinsurgency movement, coming to grips with a deepening war. Thus, in early 2006, the U.S. military was going through a concentrated period of adaptation and change. A group of intelligent and combat-experienced junior officers was working quietly to change the way that military organizations thought and operated. At the same time, a slightly older generation was applying insights its members had gained before the war to the new conditions. Some of these officers were informally allied with enlightened senior commanders, and some worked in concert with a small group of committed civilian experts inside and outside the government. The RAND Corporation established an insurgency board that brought together external researchers along with RAND analysts to examine the new environment through the lens of RAND's work on counterinsurgency since the 1950s. In some ways, RAND acted as an institutional memory bank for the new counterinsurgency movement, in part because some veteran researchers, Steve Hosmer among them, had been present at the creation in the 1950s when RAND had played a crucial early role in developing classical counterinsurgency theory. Online journals, in particular Small Wars Journal, run by Dave DeLeggi and Bill Nagel, had long been advocates of the guerrilla warfare renaissance and had run something of an underground network for the community, connecting key players, quietly prompting change, and providing a forum for discussion, debate, and the exchange of ideas. Now, their energy and commitment began to pay off, as the military establishment's system of professional journals and in-house publications began to engage with the problem. As the journals engaged, the debate widened and intensified, and the new ideas began to circulate within the military. Petraeus and Mattis, as commanders of their services' combined training centers, exercised a certain amount of influence over these journals and actively promoted the debate. The debate in the journals showed how much the military's culture had changed from the so-called zero-defect mentality of the 1970s, moving further toward a new spirit of open criticism and self-criticism. The clearest illustration of this was an article entitled Changing the Army for Counterinsurgency Operations by British Army Brigadier Nigel Alwyn Foster, which was published in the November-December 2005 issue of the Military Review and was heavily critical of the U.S. Army's performance in Iraq. The article became the subject of intense debate. The tone of the response was set by senior leaders, with Petraeus inviting Alwyn Foster to speak at the review workshop for the new field manual, and General Peter Schoonmaker, Chief of Staff of the Army, circulating the article to all senior commanders and urging them to consider its implications and take corrective action where needed. The commander of U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, General William S. Wallace, published a letter thanking Alwyn Foster for his contribution to our profession's intellectual discourse, encouraging wide discussion and debate of the critique, and arguing that the Army prides itself on its ability to critically assess our performance and seek out areas where we can improve. This openness to constructive criticism and willingness to adapt rapidly to improve field performance was a hallmark of a military institution that was fully committed to the wars it was fighting and was increasingly ready to change in order to win them. The same could not be said of all the allies in Iraq or Afghanistan, but it was increasingly true of the United States, which was beginning to master counterinsurgency and was ultimately to far outpace other armies who traditionally considered themselves adept at counter-guerrilla work. In the same time period, Colonel Bill Darley, editor of Military Review and another committed long-term advocate of the new approach, organized a counterinsurgency writing competition and published a special edition in the form of a counterinsurgency reader, followed in subsequent years by a second counterinsurgency reader and then an interagency reader. Parameters and Proceedings, the journals of the Army and Navy War Colleges, respectively, published numerous articles on counterinsurgency, as did the Joint Force Quarterly, the Marine Corps Gazette, and the individual branch journals, infantry, armor, etc. All of this brought the counterinsurgency debate fully into the light and allowed commanders in the field to access interim doctrine before the new manual was formally published. Junior officers also established secure web forums to enable them to discuss their concerns without necessarily bringing Big Army into the process. CompanyCommand.com and PlatoonLeader.org were two early examples, and both were very important bottom-up efforts, led and run by field officers on their own initiative. Steve Metz at the U.S. Army War College, Gordon McCormick at the Naval Postgraduate School, Tom Marks at the National Defense University, Frank Hoffman at the Marine Corps University, and many other academics at military and civilian educational institutions also played a key role, as did Professor Elliot Cohen of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, who convened an informal movement of like-minded experts. At times, this network acted like an insurgency within the bureaucracy, arguing its case and pushing for change in the face of outright opposition. In the wider government context, later in 2006, leaders like John Hillen, Assistant Secretary for Political Military Affairs at the State Department, Jeb Nadaner, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Stabilization Operations, and Elizabeth Kvitashvili, Director of Conflict Management and Mitigation at the U.S. Agency for International Development, worked energetically to bring their organizations together, as did Janine Davidson, Director for Stability Operations Capabilities at the Pentagon. In the event, the learning mechanisms Davidson identified, the cultural openness to be honestly self-critical, and the processes to turn that self-criticism into purposeful action to improve, gave the bureaucratic insurgents a means to change their institutions. Back in the spring of 2006, the problem was that even as this process of organizational change was gathering momentum, the war was also changing. Indeed, it was hotting up dramatically. The winter of 2005 to 2006 saw a major escalation of violence in Iraq and a spreading and intensifying Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan. In Pakistan, both the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban struck cooperative peace deals with the Pakistani army, giving them control of large swathes of the frontier and spiking infiltration into Afghanistan to unprecedented levels. In the Horn of Africa, the Somali Transitional Federal Government was ousted from Mogadishu by the Union of Islamic Courts, and Al-Qaeda cells continued to spread in coastal East Africa. The enemy was on the move. It would take another year to finalize the new doctrine, but civil and military leaders in the field needed help right now. The writing team under Con Crane circulated the draft of their new manual as widely as possible to get it out to the field, even in interim form. In Iraq, General George Casey, assisted by his personal counterinsurgency advisor, Caleb Sepp, established a counterinsurgency campaign plan, created a counterinsurgency academy outside Baghdad, and began reorienting the coalition force in Iraq to the new approach. In Afghanistan, the effort was hampered by a profusion of multinational command systems, lack of higher-level attention, and reluctance on the part of some troop-contributing nations to grasp that the conflict had evolved from a reconstruction mission into a full-blown counterinsurgency. Writing 28 Articles. Against this background of a deepening war and intellectual ferment across the government, I had just come back from a stint in Iraq working counterterrorism and counterinsurgency issues for Ambassador Hank Crumpton, coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department. Scott Cuomo's request for a concise description of what company-grade commanders needed to understand and do in counterinsurgency struck a chord with me. I had been going over my field notes from Iraq, trying to codify and organize my observations, and had a body of participant observations, interview notes, and quantitative data on which to draw, as well as my own previous command experience in earlier campaigns. But I would probably not have written 28 articles in its final form, or perhaps at all, had not a senior Pentagon official stood me up. My bureau at State had a close, though not always harmonious, working relationship with several offices in the Pentagon, including the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict. The same day Scott came to see me, I had been invited to a meeting on regional counterterrorism efforts with my opposite number, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in that office. At the last moment, just 15 minutes out, when I was already in the Pentagon parking lot, his scheduler called to cancel the meeting. It was very late on a cold, rainy afternoon, so rather than go back to the office, I sat down in a quiet corner of the Starbucks coffee shop at Pentagon City, pulled out my little black moleskin field notebook, and began to write the summary Scott had asked for. After I had boiled down dozens of observations, grouping them into key thoughts and organizing them in a chronological sequence, I was left with 28 main points. This coincidence put me in mind of the famous 27 articles, T.E. Lawrence's article in the Arab Bulletin of August 1917, a document with which both I and my readers were very familiar. It was widely read within the counterinsurgency community and was being circulated among company and platoon commanders in the field in its electronic version. 27 Articles is a concise, conversational, clearly written piece of advice for members of the Arab Bureau, Britain's wartime intelligence and unconventional warfare organization for the Palestine and Mediterranean theaters, based in Cairo, working with tribal irregulars under Prince Faisal of Mecca in an insurgency against the Ottoman Empire. Lawrence, of course, wrote of insurgency and the art of military combat advising rather than of counterinsurgency per se, but I felt that if I organized my article along similar lines and passed it to my peers in the field as a companion piece with Lawrence's already circulating article, it would resonate with them and they would readily grasp the allusion. By the early hours of the next morning, over my laptop at home, and assisted by a bottle of Laphroaig, I had the initial draft completed and sent it out by email for peer review. This process of peer review is critically important because of the nature of field observation in counterinsurgency warfare. Anyone who has ever participated in close combat or debriefed troops after a firefight knows the conundrum that hampers understanding of battle. If you weren't there, you probably don't know what happened. If you were there, you probably can't remember clearly. Close combat in complex terrain, as in counterinsurgency, is so confused and moves so fast that even people a few dozen meters away often do not know exactly what is happening. Meanwhile, those who are on the spot are subject to the psychology of crisis. Like victims of a car accident, their perceptions are heavily influenced by the expectation of imminent death or injury and the enormous shock of combat. For this reason, everyone remembers a particular engagement differently. This is nothing new. Consider David Howarth's description of the Battle of Waterloo. Afterwards, nobody in the infantry had a clear, consecutive memory of what happened. They only remembered isolated moments, glimpses through the battle smoke, sudden, piercing expressions of sound or smell or sight. The rest was a daze of fear, excitement, or horror. This makes personal observation an unreliable basis for analysis. Nevertheless, researchers in this environment have no choice but to rely on qualitative first-hand field research based on participant observation, backed up by quantitative data when available. Unfortunately, quantitative data such as those in the Significant Activities databases, SIGACTS, the military's official record of every combat incident in a campaign, tend to be highly corrupt because of the difficulties in reporting incidents and fitting the multiplicity of possible incident types into a small number of database categories. When I served in Iraq in 2007 as General Petraeus's senior counterinsurgency advisor, for example, I would often go out with units in the field to observe and advise. I would always bring with me a sheaf of the latest SIGACT reporting from that unit, would try to get alongside the actual individual, officer, or NCO who had reported a particular incident, and would show him the incident report as it appeared in the database. With every unit, and in some cases with every single report, the person who first reported the incident could no longer recognize it as it appeared in the database. This data corruption and the reductiveness of the SIGACT system tended to frustrate rigorous statistical analysis, prompting an emphasis on professional judgment and blink knowledge. Selection bias. U.S. units in the toughest areas, requiring most assistance, tended to receive the greatest attention, and the risk, stress, and effort inherent in data collection also tended to cloud judgment and skew emphasis. All of this makes peer review critical for counterinsurgency research. I listed the main contributors to this review in the acknowledgments note at the end. Many of them were and are key members of the counterinsurgency community, and all brought extremely valuable insights to the process and proposed changes to what I had initially written. Thus, the final version that follows represents the collective judgment of the entire middle tier of the counterinsurgency movement, not solely my own views. No template. Within 48 hours of my sending the article out for review, however, the email containing the document had gone viral around the U.S. government, the U.S. military, and allied forces, a real indication of the speed with which the informal counterinsurgent underground could pass information to commanders out in the field. Over the next week, I received dozens of emails from people who were using the document in Iraq and Afghanistan, often including valuable suggestions for changes. Within a couple of months, Darley had published the article in Military Review. It had also been published in the Marine Corps Gazette, and Crane's team adapted it as an appendix to Counterinsurgency, FM 324. In part, this was probably because the article filled a felt need, but the more important aspect was that it showed how fast information could circulate from the bottom up. The article was subsequently translated into Arabic and Spanish and used in Afghanistan and Iraq by both coalition and local forces. I received several emails from Afghan and Iraqi officers offering their commentaries and thanks. The less positive aspect of such circulation was the tendency by many readers, despite the warning at the front of the article, to use it as a template. As I have emphasized in detail already, there are no standard templates or universal solutions in counterinsurgency. Fundamentals and principles exist, but they require judgment in application, and there is no substitute for studying the environment in detail, developing locally tailored solutions, and being prepared to adjust them in an agile way as the situation develops. For publication here, I have preserved the original text of the article because it has been widely quoted and referred to in numerous other publications, so any substantive amendment to the main text would introduce considerable confusion. However, I have added expanded footnotes and annotations where subsequent events warrant it.